From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process with today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On Story features discussions with screenwriters and filmmakers who use the language of film and television to tell a story. All of our content is recorded live at the Austin Film Festival, in year-round events, and in up-to-the-minute interviews. On today's episode, actor and filmmaker James Franco.
You know, it's not about now, like, showing all the research I've done, preparation I've done. It's about helping them tell that story.
And later in our program, Academy Award winner Chris Cooper.
Half of my fun is the research and the digging and whatever is needed to find that character.
On Story will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Actor and filmmaker James Franco first rose to prominence on the cult sensation Freaks and Geeks and has since followed with unforgettable roles in films both large and small. He won a Golden Globe early in his career for his portrayal of film icon James Dean and was nominated for the Academy Award in the Best Actor category for his role in 127 Hours. His latest film, The Disaster Artist, which he also directed, chronicles the making of Tommy Wiseau's 2003 cult film, The Room, which is widely considered one of the worst movies ever made. The film stars both James Franco and his brother Dave Franco, and is written by Austin Film Festival regulars Scott Neustadter and Michael Weber. Franco's portrayal of Wiseau has earned him 2 Golden Globe nominations. Producer Barry Josephson spoke with James Franco at the 19th annual Austin Film Festival in 2012.
It's good to be here. I love this festival. This is actually where I reunited with Judd Apatow, and we started talking about doing a new project after Freaks and Geeks and ended up making Pineapple Express. So that happened all at this festival. So the first big thing that I did as an actor was Freaks and Geeks, but I was still young and I didn't realize how unique that setup was, where we had incredible writers, you know, a lot of whom have, you know, gone on to do, you know, really great things, Mike White and, you know, all these other people. And then great directors, Miguel Arteta and, you know, people like that would come in and direct the episodes. And so when it ended, I wasn't too upset. Everybody else was upset. And I thought, oh, this is great. I can go on and do my movie career. And I did some good things and I did some and bad things. And Judd, it's funny because it just happened this morning. Judd was at the airport and his driver wasn't there. And so he came in my car and I invited him to the screening of my film, The Ape. And it was this, you know, tiny, tiny little movie that was based on a play I'd written with this woman named Meriwether Williams, who was a head writer on SpongeBob SquarePants. And I invited him and he came, and it's like a dark comedy. And he said after, you know, it's weird you're doing all these kind of dramas or whatever you want to call those 3 movies I had just done. But when you make your own film, you know, it's like you bring in comedic elements. It's like you're trying to come back to comedy. And he said, I was always surprised when you didn't do more comedies after Freaks and Geeks. I think you should. And so I had just done those 3 movies and he had just done 40-Year-Old Virgin and he was just about to do Knocked Up with Seth. And I was like, man, I want to be in their boat. I said, yeah, I'll do anything with you. And so we didn't know that it was going to be Pineapple at that point. We were just looking at a number of things. After Freaks and Geeks, Seth kind of had a hard time as an actor for a while. He did a little part in Donnie Darko and, you know, he did Undeclared. But after that, like, he was really a writer, and he and judges gave him writing assignments. They do rewrite assignments. I think they did, like, rewrites on Bad Boys 2 and, you know, stuff like that. On Anchorman, he had a little part, and then 40-Year-Old Virgin, and then Knocked Up. And he was still kind of coming up when we talked about Pineapple. And so when I read the script, I thought, oh, they want me to play the dude that has a girlfriend and is not the kind of character role. And so we had a meeting after I read the script, just Seth and Judd and I, and I almost didn't say it. I finally said, just like a little kid or something, I was like, oh, I wish I could play his role. And because we had never talked about which role we were going to play. And they were like, oh, you know what? We had just been talking before you got here. And we think you should play the Saul role. Because, you know, years before they, you know, the script was a couple of years old. And I think Seth had like planned to play him more like he was going to play him. And like, as a, like a snowboarder pot dealer or something, I don't know. And, so they were into it, and you know, it was really, I think it really came out of the fact that they knew me so well and would trust me doing a part like that. Because at that point, even the studio that I'd worked with on multiple films, Sony, didn't trust that I could do it. So those two guys were really the ones that believed that I could play a role like that. And then we had to do a test for Sony. I did a little cameo in Knocked Up playing myself, and that I didn't realize it at the time, but that was like my audition for Sony to allow me to do Pineapple Express.
Let's stick with Judd for one second, because I worked with Judd years ago on Cable Guy, and I'd been following his career and everything that he'd written, and he just seems to write so perfectly for the form, and that he gets emotion, and he, you know, he also will tailor to an actor or to a situation. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because you've had such a great experience with improv, and I think sometimes that probably works and sometimes it doesn't work as well if the filmmaker isn't on your side.
I think there's a few things that Judd does that gets the results that we all love. He definitely writes for performers. So just for example, on Freaks and Geeks, there was a pilot script before anyone was cast, and there were descriptions of the characters. But when they went out and cast those roles, they weren't trying to fit performers to the descriptions of the characters in the script. They just cast people that they were interested in and thought could, you know, really inhabit this world and had a lot to, I guess, you know, bring to this world. So, and then once everybody was cast, they started writing to us, and they'd bring us in, they'd ask us stories about ourselves. And the show took place in the 80s, but, you know, they'd, you know, work personal stories and their own personal stories as well, but really making sure that it was material that these performers could shine, you know, with. And he'll do that, I think, with all his movies. I mean, I think that's his process. So like when working with Seth, like, you know, on Knocked Up, it was just, you know, tons and tons of readings beforehand, working things out beforehand, and really just making sure that this character was something that Seth could just, you know, knock it out with. So then the other thing that he does in his best films is, it sounds cheesy, but bring in the heart, I guess. So if you hear them talk about something like Superbad, which was a script that they, you know, Seth and Evan had written when they were like 13, right, originally. They've sent me an early draft. I was gonna actually work with a high school class and have them direct the 13-year-old version of Superbad. I haven't looked at it yet, but my guess is it's heavier on stupid jokes and it has less of the, you know, the heart at the center, but, you know, between the, you know, about this friendship. And once that movie started going, the big influences that Judd had on it was to tease out that relationship so that it wasn't just a bunch of stupid jokes, that it had an emotional arc underneath all of that. And you can see that in all the movies, in Pineapple as well. I mean, it's really kind of, I guess, how the bromance started. But to me, when all those movies started coming out, it was this fresh thing in these, you know, mainstream comedy movies where it's not just dudes acting stupid, that there is something to kind of tie into, something emotional to tie into. And so that was one of the big secrets. And then the other thing is the improv. So Judd has the power to just shoot as much as he wants. So he will just keep the cameras rolling. On Funny People, I only know this because I worked with the crew right after that. We did like That year, Seth and I did a little spot for the Oscars that year, and it was the same crew with Janusz Kaminski. And they shot on these film roll, 22-minute long film rolls. So they're
huge mags.
Huge mags. And he will just roll that and not stop. And so you'll run through the scene, and then you don't stop, and it just, you know, just keep playing. And he'll have, and this thing I'm about to talk about started on Knocked Up, I think, where he'll have other writers on set just coming up with other gags, you know, behind him and writing things down that they'll hand to him. So the cameras won't stop, and they'll just hand him things, and he'll be like, either like, oh, come on, give me something better. Or it's sort of this open improvisational space where he can throw out ideas, the actors can try things. And when you have a 22-minute mag, it's almost like when you go through it, it's like you've just shot a sitcom's worth of material in like one take. I'm sure it's very expensive. Like on Knocked Up, like the word is they shot like 2 million feet of film, or like more than they shot for Speed 2. But when you do that, you need, I think, a few things. You need people that you trust. I mean, at least I do, so that you can just try stupid things, stupid ideas, and you know that if it's truly stupid and doesn't work, that it won't be used. So you're, you know, more willing to kind of just
feel safe,
throw yourself out there and improvise. And then also, I think the other key to that, because I've been on other movies where there's improvisation that is more, it's not really improvisation. It's more like somebody dictating just, you know, throwaway lines to you, rather than the performers being allowed to sort of sit in the scene and react to the circumstances, instead of just kind of being a mouthpiece for, you know, writers off screen throwing things in. So I think a healthy mix of the two, you know, gets the best results in that situation.
Switching gears a little bit, you're being offered so many movies. You could have the opportunity of just going that route, but you seem very inspired to create, write, and direct. You know, what sort of inspires you? What's your starting point often for projects that you've worked on?
I feel like at this point, I'm grateful, you know, with what I've been able to be a part of, and I've done, you know, a bunch of movies that I love and I'm very proud of, both as actor, director, writer. At this point, I can just say like, oh, I just want to do stuff that interests me. I don't need to like make career moves or anything like that. It's become less of a concern for me, and I feel like, you know, I should be grateful. So one of the reasons I teach, and it sounds cheesy, but we even like make a joke about it in this latest movie I've done with Seth, but I do want to just give back and give opportunities to passionate filmmakers that are hard workers, and just give them, you know, some opportunities that I've been given. So it kind of gets me out of this headspace of, oh, I've got to be in the next big hit and da, 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 da. It's like so much more refreshing to go to a place where people are so eager to, you know, make movies. It's and they're so pure about it. And it's just, you know, really about just making good movies more than anything else.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with filmmaker James Franco speaking with Barry Josephson at the 19th Austin Film Festival in 2012.
With 127 hours, which was just so brilliant, James, it was such an incredible performance. Was that script, was it the story that inspired you? Was it, you know, Danny Boyle's interpretation?
I can talk about that script. I mean, that was, I think that whole movie was a puzzle to figure out every step of the way. So Danny Boyle read about Aaron Ralston when he first got out of the canyon, and approached Aaron about doing a movie back then. Aaron at that time was very interested in making a documentary style movie that he would be in. So I imagine there would be him giving interviews and then reenactments, and Danny just, you know, wasn't interested in that. It would be more along the lines of Touching the Void, if anyone knows that documentary, great documentary. Right. But Danny didn't want to do that with this piece. And especially didn't want to have Aaron do the reenactments, because even though he had gone through the experience himself, we like to think that there are some things that actors bring, mainly, you know, they're able to convey emotions to an audience that even somebody that's been through an experience can tell you about, but maybe can't tell you emotionally about it through a performance. So he didn't want to do that. 5 years later or so, Danny had won the Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire, and Aaron hadn't made his documentary yet. So they got back together, and Aaron was now willing to listen to Danny's ideas, but nobody else. His screenwriter, Simon Pufoy, is that his name?
Yeah.
From Slumdog, didn't think it could be done. And he didn't want to write it. He didn't want to do it with Danny. He said, this is an impossible project, not only because so much of it would involve a single performer in a confined space, but on top of that, Danny's approach was to make it even more isolated than maybe Aaron's account of it in his book. So if you adapted Aaron's book, you could have stuff before, his climbing trips before, and you see him wild and reckless climber, you know, climbing all the peaks in Colorado, and then you could have the incident, but then you could have this alternate kind of scenario of the family wondering where he is, and working up the rescue mission and the helicopters looking for them. So there was a way to kind of cut away from Aaron's story that you'd think that's maybe the way to go. That will pull us out of that maybe uncinematic scenario of a guy alone. But Danny didn't want to do that. He thought, you know, he should give the audience the experience of being trapped in that canyon with that character. That being said, he'll cut away to flashbacks or hallucinations. And that does give a little bit of what I'm talking about, this respite from the isolation. But even in those, if you watch closely, I didn't perform in any of those sequences. It's just usually from my character's point of view, and maybe you'll see a hand or maybe a body, but it's not me. Danny was very clear in his own head that even though the movie would be going to flashbacks, the character wouldn't be able to escape. You wouldn't see him ever out of that canyon. And then what started happening is, because he shot it that way, he could have me in the canyon having a dialogue with the people in the hallucination. So the ex-girlfriend is sort of talking in my hallucination or memory. And then when it cuts back to my reaction, it's just me in the canyon. So it was a way to just build that pressure even more of isolation and being trapped. I think finally what convinced Simon that it could be done was the idea of the video camera and talking to the video camera as both something that Aaron actually did, which was great, and it's also a great storyteller's tool, because there you can have a character talking about the most intimate side of himself, his most intimate feelings, talking ostensibly to his family and friends, thinking he's going to die. But then what's shown in the actual movie in the theater, it's like an aside, like a Shakespearean aside, and he's talking directly to the audience. It creates an even more sort of intimate space just by the structure and the tools that he's using, in addition to the way that he shot it. You know, I mean, you don't get away from my face in that movie. So you, as an audience member, I mean, people would tell me, like, after coming out of that screening, and by the way, people did pass out in every screening I went to. So there was something psychosomatic. I mean, it was so intense. There was something happening, and people would come out and tell me, like, it felt like an action movie. It felt like I went on a ride, but there's no big, you know, kind of action sequence, really. It's just, you're just there with the guy, but it's because everybody knows what's going to happen. So once he's trapped, it's like the audience is trapped in there, yes, in that box with him.
Yep.
And it just, the pressure just builds and builds and builds and builds. It wasn't just a new experience for me acting, you know, most of my scenes alone. That's new for the DPs. Like, how do you cover a scene with only one person? It was new for the director. Like, usually, you know, you go and talk to the actors and you talk about what the conflict is or the situation and, you know, bring that to life. Like, when you have one actor, what ended up happening is, like, Danny and the DPs almost became the performers opposite me. And, you know, he hired two DPs of equal stature. Danny intended for them to shoot in slightly different styles so that even if you didn't have an antagonist character, you'd sort of have antagonistic looks or shooting styles, and it would feel kind of jagged, or they'd, you know, be jarring in ways. It didn't quite work that way because both DPs, I guess, just found like, oh, there's an optimal way of kind of covering this kind of thing, and they sort of started shooting in the same way. Early on in the scene, where the character gets trapped, you know, I try to just pull my arm out with brute strength. On that take, Danny said, all right, I want you to try and pull the arm out. Do everything you can. You kick, yank, do whatever you can to get it out, but you won't get it out. And then don't stop until I say cut. I said, all right, that's fine. You know, I'm going to get beat up and bruised if I really do that. And he's like, yeah, I know you will. I said, okay. And I said, okay, well, I hope you get in the first take because I don't know how many I can do. And he's like, all right, just don't stop. So then, so I did it. And when he said cut, I guess it was like it had been 21 minutes of doing that. I was like exhausted, and I wish I got better pictures because by the end of that movie, I had bruises all over. But what we found after that 21 minute take was with a movie like this, where so much of it is based on behavior and these little peaks and valleys of minor accomplishments leading up to the major escape accomplishment, that it would be too taxing and maybe deliver a less naturalistic result if we tried to just set up every little moment. Okay, you're 1 minute into trying to pull it out. Okay, now you're 5 minutes into trying to pull the arm out. You're a little more tired and you're kicking. All right, it's 15 minutes into it. You're even more tired and you're kicking. Here, he had 21 minutes of, you know, realistic build of exhaustion, frustration. And then, you know, all through that, the DPs would just move the cameras. These were these small little digital cameras. They could just, you know, get their close up in the same take, you know, pull back, get a medium, get over here, get different angles all throughout the take. So we didn't need to, we really didn't need to do a second take after that. It's like he had it all there, and he has a performance of a guy getting progressively tired and frustrated. And so that's how we learn to do most of the behavioral scenes, just go and really do it. By doing that 21 minute take and then long takes in other scenes after that, I got water and wasn't there trapped for 5 days, but I guess I did it over the course of 2 months too. So in its own way, that's draining as well. But it's like I went through the footsteps that Aaron went through, just finding those moments in a more organic way, I think helped with that performance. I both work with actors and I act for directors. When I was a young actor, I'd go and do a lot of research. I was a fanatic about preparation, partly because acting was all I had. And so that's where I put my energy. Once I was signed onto a movie, you could be sure that I just do everything possible to get into that world. So even, you know, stupid, unnecessary things like for Freaks and Geeks, you know, we were all young actors and the show shot in L.A., but I knew that one of the writers, the creators, Paul Feig, was from outside of Detroit. So I went out there on my own, went to his high school, met his audio video teacher, went to the room where he had been a geek and like had the conversations that these characters have. And I don't know why. Like, I guess I just thought, like, all right, he's writing about, you know, experiences he had in this place, so I should go see it. But, or, you know, for Tristan and Isolde, I signed on like 8 months in advance. I didn't know how to ride a horse. I rode a horse every day for those 8 months, 7 days a week. And these were like movie horses. I was like riding the horse that you see in Antonio Banderas's Zorro. And those aren't cheap horses to rent. So I was paying for all that every day, doing like sword fighting in my old girlfriend's backyard, destroyed the lawn because we just, you know, do these stupid sword fight things every day. I would do all this stuff and find all these things, but not run it by the director. And so when I said before that about being a character in a story, it's not just about the character and revealing everything about the character. It's about also telling the story. And that's kind of where I got hung up. I'd have all this stuff that I'd want to put in, and the director would be like basically probably thinking, well, okay, that's great, but I'm not, you know, this isn't a horseback riding movie, or, you know, like there's just no room for, you know, 8 months of training. Like, I learned all these tricks. I could stand on the horse's back while it galloped and all this stuff. It's just like, that's cool, James, but like, there's no, it's not for our movie. Like, what, you know? So basically the secret is, for me, I mean, this is just the way I do it. Screenwriters, you don't want to think otherwise. I think it's a director's medium. And so when I'm on a set, I'm now pretty sure it's a director that I believe in. And what I'm trying to do as an actor is help him or her achieve their vision. And that's it. You know, it's not about now like showing all the research I've done, preparation I've done. It's about helping them tell that story.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Chris Cooper is known for a broad range of work in supporting roles. From July Johnson in TV's Lonesome Dove to Robert Hansen in Breach, Colonel Fitz in American Beauty, to Al Templeton in Hulu's original miniseries 11-22-63. Chris Cooper won both an Academy Award and a Golden Globe in 2003 for his portrayal of John LaRoche in the film Adaptation. And his other film credits include August, Osage County, Syriana, Jarhead, and Capote. Writer Michael Knoll spoke with Cooper at the 22nd Austin Film Festival in 2015.
I'd like to start with a general question about the way that your work is talked about. To quote one website, they said that Chris Cooper is known for his intense, understated performances. And y'all laugh, right? Because like intense makes sense. I mean, if you watch Adaptation or American Beauty or Breach, those are intense roles. Mm-hmm. But the word understated, I'm not sure fits. John LaRoche in Adaptation, to some extent, is a talker. In Breach, you know, Robert Hansen is at times openly manipulative. In American Beauty, there's a fight scene that's not at all understated. It's hard to watch. And so I wonder, is that how you approach a character, taking what is on the script and maybe, I don't know, understating it?
I guess to answer your question is they have tacked on to me a character actor. I'm seeing that as less and less a part of film. I mean, you know, if they need a character actor, they'll go find that character. And then again, what you're saying is fine with me, because nothing more boring could be than to, you know, repeat yourself film after film after film. And half of my fun is the research and the digging and whatever is needed to find that character.
In Breach, you play FBI agent Robert Hansen, the biggest traitor in U.S. history, sold secrets to the Russians for a lot of money. I know that you did research about his motivation, and that's a question in the film. What is his motivation for doing these things? And I wonder how much you considered that, you know, in addition to like, why did he do what he did? But like, what did it feel like?
One of the one sentence summaries about Robert Hansen was that he is a man who could compartmentalize his life. We kind of handled him with kid gloves, because we actually went back to the locations where he did his final drop and where he was nailed. That was in Virginia. And, his wife and children were still in that neighborhood, mm-hmm. you know. There were other aspects about Hansen that weren't covered in the film. He frequented strip clubs. Talk about contradictory. He would meet with some of these women, and he would try to convert them. He himself had actually converted to Catholicism, and then he went on to Opus Dei. So, pretty mixed up cat.
That's what the poster said, right? There's a moment in that film, there's a scene, it's early on, when you and Ryan Philippe, who played the agent, who sort of like caught Hansen. It's Philippe's first day, the agent's first day, and he sort of sneaks into the office, and then your character sort of says at the end, by the way, don't ever go into my office again. And you have a sneer that you give, and it's sort of meant for yourself. I don't think that he sees it. And it's just the most awful sort of evil look. And you may not remember this, but I'm curious, when you think about some of the facial expressions that you use with a character, is that something that you practice in the mirror, or do you just sort of like get the feeling right, where you're like, I know what it feels like in this moment, and it'll just, you know, come?
I was determined to give Ryan's character a hard time. We actually had, forgive me because I forget the names now, but we have the man who was assigned to Robert Hansen, Eric O'Neill, and we had him for about a week and a half. We were doing just exercises on how to open up a computer, take a computer apart. You know, how in-depth do you want to go? But we observed him. I had 1,000 questions for him. The one thing that he said to me was, you know, a thing on, was it Saturday Night Live? Or his close talker, doesn't keep the distance. Hansen would constantly encroach on Eric O'Neill and just constantly push his buttons, you know, trying to break him down. I still believe Hansen had no suspicion. Obviously, he had no suspicion about Eric O'Neill being assigned to tail him. But there were little quirks that I hope people caught in there. Another thing that he mentioned was when you're walking down a hall, he would drive himself into you and drive you into the wall. I mean, I don't know what to make of it. Don't question it, but it's certainly something interesting to use.
And you do that in the film.
Yeah, we made a point of that, certainly. Yeah.
So you had this antagonistic relationship with the other actor that you were working with, like Ryan Philippe, not with him personally, but with his character. Like, your characters were not friends in the film by any stretch of the imagination. And when the scene would end, when you sort of step off set, he would go to his corner and you would go to your corner. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's always how you work, if you have to sort of maintain a kind of emotional framework.
No, I kind of feel out each project, but that was certainly the way Ryan and I had dealt with each other.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Academy Award winner Chris Cooper speaking with Michael Knoll at the 22nd Austin Film Festival in 2015.
Just to jump to another film, because what you mentioned was so strong, working with Wes Bentley in American Beauty. So many things about that film to talk about, but the night where we have the where we're up in his bedroom and I have realized that he's gone into my office, which is off bounds to the rest of the family. That scene has gotten so confused, and there's been so many misinterpretations about why Colonel Fitz was so concerned that his son went into his study. But when I go up to his bedroom and we have that confrontation, it was a really hard night. Doing that scene after scene after scene and taking him down to the floor and just coming so close to beating your son for a very specific reason that might not be so easily understood. That was a night where after each take, we went to each other's separate corners.
For sort of the emotional impact of a scene like, you know, that particular fight scene from American Beauty, how long does it take for that to wear off? At a certain point, you're going to become Chris Cooper again. You're not going to be that character, but that's not an emotional energy that's going to just vanish when the scene's over.
No, it'll keep you up that night because you're on a high. I mean, you expend a lot of energy and a lot of emotion, but I'm not one of those guys, I don't think, that takes his work home with him. Marianne might disagree. God. But like I said, as time goes by, I'm learning how to deal with this stuff and just enjoy the process more.
In order to shoot an emotionally sort of fraught scene like that, you must have to do some preparatory work, not to understand the character, but to prepare yourself for what has got to be kind of a grueling experience. Like, how do you prepare yourself for a scene like that?
For an actor, I think it comes down to four basic things. For a historical character, then you've got research. And like Robert Hansen, I had five wonderful books that went from his high school days and talked to high school students with him and people that worked right across the hall from him in the CIA. There was some real gold in there. Your life experience, what life experience you can bring. And if you don't have anything that you can bring from life experience, you got nothing else but your imagination. And then the fourth thing, I'm believing more and more, it's just whatever talent that individual actor can bring to the role. So dealing with Wes in those scenes, it's like bringing your life experience as a dad and going way beyond where you have ever been, but imagining that loved one in front of you and going for it.
In that film, like, you work really closely with one actor in particular. Almost all of your scenes are sort of two people. And that seems to be a recurring thing in your work. So in Adaptation, it's you and Meryl Streep. In American Beauty, it's you and your son. And even in August, Osage County, which is, you're in a scene at a dinner table with a lot of people. And the room at times seems to narrow down between, like, you and Meryl Streep or you and one of the other actors. Do you look for opportunities when you're reading a script for that where you can really work closely and collaborate even perhaps with another actor?
Well, it's a good theory, but I mean, that's news to me, you know. But I see where you're coming from. Something that I just finished, again, this one is a 9-part miniseries, and I'm strongly in the first 2 hours. The other actor, that's the only guy I worked with. To answer your question, I think it's simply, I'm known as a supporting actor, a strong supporting actor with pretty good roles, so I'm likely to work with the leads in the film.
You mentioned the word supporting actor, and so you won Best Supporting Actor, the Oscar, for Adaptation. In that film, you play John LaRoche, who's this guy who's out hunting orchids. He's missing a couple front teeth. And even in the film, the other characters talk about him like he's a caricature. Your portrayal of him is so much more complex than that, in part because he seems very aware of himself and of how he appears and how he talks and the things that he says and the effect that he has on people. And I wonder if that was in the script. Is that something that you sort of discovered in that character on your own?
I'll tell you what was very, very unusual. I've told the story a number of times, man. I hope, but I think it's kind of interesting. Well, I live in Massachusetts. I drove into New York that day to audition with Spike. If you're familiar with the audition process, you'll be called in, you'll do your reading. And if the director likes you, he'll say, that was good, let's try this, or let's look at it this way, or he tweaks it a little different. What happened with John LaRoche, and it hasn't happened with many other characters, you know, you read a script and you get a pretty good idea of where you're pretty much supposed to go emotionally. But this one, I was not confused. I just told Spike, I can't give you my definitive audition for John LaRoche. There are too many ways to play him. I see so many ways I could play this character. Just please allow me to show you what I have in mind. And so as it turned out, I think that the audition went on for about 45 minutes. We did easily four scenes, three or four different ways. And then the great thing is that Spike said, I like this process. So you got the job, but when we shoot, we're going to work like this. Then it turned out that in the end result, huge surprise to me, because that left Spike take by take with a lot of different options. And until his final cut, I guess when we saw it at the premiere, it was quite a surprise to see what he chose in my performance.
So did you ever have a coherent sense of that character, or was it this multifaceted? No, I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean that, like, was he so sort of multifaceted that you could never get a, you know, clear?
No, you just had, here's one little example. It was a scene where I pick her up in my truck and we're going to go out and look for one of these ghost orchids. And I pick her up in this just god-awful van. So Spike said, okay, on this take, this is this New York journalist coming down to Florida. You're smart as a whip. You know, she's lucky to be able to spend the time that she does with you. You're pretty full of yourself. Okay, so we did that. Turn it completely around and say, you're this Florida redneck. You got this New Yorker journalist, very smart. You think you're smart? This woman's really smart, and you're intimidated. You're intimidated by this woman. So let's try that. And then we'd try some other things. But that's an example of the extremes that you can play with.
I think it's that scene, too, is where you're talking about fish. You had collected tropical fish, and then you decided one day, done with fish. That's the line that you sort of end on, because she says, well, how could you possibly give up something that you love? And he said, done with fish. And it's such an opaque line. It's hard to read your character on that line. And I wonder how you read it. How did you?
Because he could easily do that. It was the point where he got into pornography. It's just a way to make money. He had his own greenhouse for a while until Hurricane came and destroyed that. It affected him. I think we see in the scene how much it affected, devastated him. But I think it was very, very clear he could just move on. And I think he had a chip on his shoulder. I don't think he related that well with women before he met Meryl. I think he had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder.
You grew up in Kansas City, not known as the greatest arts community in the country. Although it's not nothing, as a Kansan, I feel like I should stick up for it a little bit. But you grew up in Kansas City. I believe you spent some time with cattle. And so you grew up, you know, not part of the Hollywood scene at all. And I don't know what kind of theater was available to you then. When you play a role like that, or when you play a role like you do in August Osage County, do you feel a connection to those characters because of sort of your background, or is that not really a part of it?
Well, I can certainly relate to my extreme shyness as a young man and even in college. And I say, I got tired of myself. I said, this, you know, I enjoy the company of women, but I can really be intimidated and shy. And, you know, it's really one of the reasons as well that I got involved with theater, because it's a pretty balanced mix of men and and women. But yeah, I can go back in my life and put pieces together that, you know, just put a little puzzle together and different parts of my life, and hopefully I'll find something that clicks. I was totally intimidated knowing I was going to work with Meryl. But what a great girl. We stayed at the same, you know, L.A. housing where actors stay when they're shooting a film there. And 3 or 4 days before we shot our first scene, her assistant called and said, Meryl would like to meet you. The assistant came down first, I think, to give Meryl the word that it was maybe okay to hang out with this guy. But it was just terrific. I mean, she's such a down-to-earth girl, and we just talked about politics, family, whatever. Broke the ice, and we've been pretty good friends ever since.
When you won the award for Best Supporting Actor, you actually thanked her. She was, I think, by far got the most sort of thanks in terms of the film. And I believe your phrase was like, it was like playing jazz working with her. Like, was it in terms of playing off of one another, in terms of...
This was one of the few films where a kind of improvisation was used. Spike kind of needed extra little bits that he wanted in the film that would come to mind. So we had a telephone conversation, Meryl's character, Suzanne and John LaRoche, and I was supposed to make her laugh. And I dreamed all this bizarre stuff that I apparently grew in my greenhouse, you know, spinach that I could grow off a wall or whatever I dreamed up. What I'm getting at is, we oftentimes would open the scene with little improvisational dialogue, work into the dialogue, and work ourselves out with improvisation. And never done that before. So many scenes I wish were in the film that unfortunately just had to go. But it was an interesting, exciting way of working.
You've mentioned Meryl Streep a couple of times, and... you worked again with her again in August, Osage County. In that film, there's a scene, I mentioned it earlier, where everybody's at dinner, and it's announced that you are sort of the leading man of the family now. Sure. And so you're going to say the prayer before the meal. And then, to some extent, you and Meryl Streep's character get into a kind of battle, which has got to be a little intimidating to know that you're going to go sort of head-to-head in an antagonistic way with her, because... I mean, she owns that film to some extent. I mean, she is a major character. How do you approach a scene where you're going to have to sort of match up with somebody of, you know, use the word talent, of her talent, and also the incredible lines that she was given?
Well, I mean, those 3 days, that was an 18-page scene. We shot it in less than 3 days. This is where the director comes in. I mean, we shot that confrontation any number of times, and John said, don't be so confrontational, this take, you know, show her your love. That's where the director comes in, to make those little adjustments. And I have things going on in my head that for that scene I want to get across to her, and sometimes the director wants something else, and you make that adjustment.
In that scene, at times... you're provoking not so much her, but another character with some lines about eating meat and the fear that you ingest when you eat meat. Yeah. And yet, in other moments in that exact same scene, you're playing the peacemaker, like you're trying to sort of smooth out some hurt feelings. And I wonder, if was that difficult to balance, both sort of needling somebody and also smoothing over?
Isn't that family? I mean, it's not... that's the life experience that you can bring and the texture that you have to find to play that scene. And it wasn't hard. I mean, drag it out, but this was very much like a low-budget film with big names in it. We were out in the middle of Oklahoma, and housing was difficult to find. So what they found were just finished condominiums that they... furnished for us, and everybody lived right next door to each other. And that was probably one of the greatest things that they came up with. We had night after night potluck. We'd often meet over at Merrill's, spend a couple of hours together. Man, this was during the presidential debates with Obama and Mitt Romney. We were watching all that. And just helped to get a real family feel.
So to move south from Oklahoma, we're in Texas. And I think there must be some sort of law that if we don't talk about Lonesome Dove, then we'll be run out of town. Mm. And that was early in your career. I wonder if you had the sense as you were shooting that it was going to become the thing that it has become. I mean, this sort of epic experience. I just met somebody the other day who's named their daughter Gus after one of the characters in that. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you knew then that this was something special or that it was just a role that you were getting to play.
No, I knew it was special. I had read some of McMurtry's other books, Cadillac Jack, and I was living in New York at that time. And they had already been to California and read a bunch of actors. I knew that they were only reading a handful of actors in New York. I didn't know how I got that audition, but I worked my tail off knowing this audition was coming. Then you're starting out with Larry McMurtry, Pulitzer Prize-winning book. You got Duvall, Tommy Lee, Ricky Schroeder, excellent talents. And I wanted to be a part of that. I had done one feature. John Sayles gave me my first feature job.
Matawan.
Inmate One. Yeah. And who could be more lucky an actor to get that as a first film, working with James Earl Jones and other actors who are dear friends now, David Strathairn and Mary McDonald. You know, besides being a great storyteller, John loves to slip in history. And this was the story of the 1920 coal mining wars in West Virginia. And America knows nothing about it. And it's a huge piece of our history. So for a first-time film actor, what a blessing. When that film came out, I said, oh, man, I got it made. I didn't get a job for a year and a half. And then, I mean, I went back to theater. And then Lonesome Dove came along, and I knew it had great possibilities.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, and Brian Ramos. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Ava Mites. Editing help from Brian Ramos, Jamal Knox, and Samuel Herbert. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.